Yeah, we did. Norm car broke down.
By the way, had food all made.
What's your first name?
Lily.
Got to acknowledge everybody that brings treats, thank you.
Oh, no, don't do that.
Boy, you brought something, didn't you?
Yeah, I did, but I brought it because... Yeah, don't do that.
Sure?
Yeah.
Okay.
There's some money in there already.
Good. Where's the clock?
It's done.
20 seconds.
Good morning, everybody, or good afternoon. Welcome to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradox class. I want to say thank you very, very much to Val and Nancy and an anonymous other person who did not want to be named for bringing the treats. So say thank you to them. Very good. Well, we have Dr. Ross with us this morning, and next week is Easter, so we need to take a vote. Yes, an actual vote. If you want to meet next week for Easter, raise your hand. Not two hands, one hand. Okay. Wow, we're just about even. No? Okay, we're going to meet. All right, so we're meeting next week at Easter. I just decided we got enough votes to do that. All right, this is really important. Are you ready? You listening?
Yes.
Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson decide they're going to go camping. They pitched their tent under the stars and they went to sleep. Holmes woke Watson up in the middle of the night and said, "Watson, look up at the sky and tell me what you see." Watson said, I see millions and millions of stars. And Holmes said, "And what do you deduce from that?" And Watson was so thrilled that Sherlock Holmes would ask him this question. And he said, "Well, if there are millions of stars, and even if a few of those stars have planets, it's quite likely that there are some planets like Earth out there. And if there are a few planets like Earth out there, there might also be life like Earth." Holmes said, "Watson, you're an idiot. It means somebody stole our tent." All right, let's say a prayer. Heavenly Father, we bless you and we thank you for this class that Hugh's been a part of for almost 40 years. I've been a part of for 25 now, I think. Lord, we've gotten so many blessings from you, from Dr. Ross, with this class. We thank you. Thank you that we live in a country where we can still speak our mind and study about you, Lord. We ask your blessing on Dr. Ross as he teaches us today and each one of us as we go our way this afternoon. Thank you. We are so grateful, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen. Please welcome Dr. Hugh Ross.
Well, thank you, Ross. And people often ask me, well, when did this class actually get launched? Well, it was November of 1974. So you can figure out how many years this class has been running. Okay. Ross and others have been talking to me about what the next series is going to be. And Ross, you're not the only one that's saying, can you talk about fine-tuning? And I've been doing a fine-tuning series with our scholar community at Reasons to Believe. This is our community of about 180 doctoral level scholars around the world. And so once we wrap up this series on human exceptionalism, we'll launch a series on fine-tuning. And to give you a little bit of a taste for what we're doing here is that, for 2,000 years, Christians and non-Christians have recognized that the fine-tuning argument for God is the most compelling scientific argument for the God of the Bible and the Christian faith. And for that reason, atheists and agnostics have worked hard to try to find a way to rebut that. In fact, I remember the first public debate I did was with an atheist philosopher. And he said, you know, let's debate, evidence for God. And he said, I already know what you're going to talk about. You're going to talk about design and fine-tuning. I says, as an atheist, I agree that's the best argument for the Christian faith. But I'm going to demolish you. So anyway, we had the debate. And I remember his 13-year-old son coming up to him afterwards and said, nice demolishment, Dad. So we'll tell you more about that debate later. But since this is kind of the go-to argument for the Christian faith, at least from the standpoint of the Book of Nature, I'm going to review for you, okay, what are the fundamentals of the design argument for God, and what are the responses of scholars who are trying to get around that argument, and really try to equip you to deal with their responses in a way that I think actually makes the argument far more powerful. Okay. Probably this week and next week we'll wrap up our series on human exceptionalism. So that might be a good way to celebrate Easter next week. And if you haven't been with us for a while, all these class episodes are video recorded, and you'll find them at paradoxes.org. Go to paradoxes.org, that you'll see them archived. And by the way, they're on YouTube. They're actually on several channels. Last time I counted, this class gets out on 5 different YouTube channels. And there may only be a dozen or so of us here in person, a few dozen participate virtually online, but our biggest audience are people who download the recordings. And it runs anywhere from 1,300 to 59,000 people that download the recordings. So, when you come to the microphone, you're going to be saying hi to a lot of people. Well, let's just pick up where we left off last week. And the debate is, are humans truly exceptional? And does the human species include not just modern humans, but Neanderthals, Denisovans, Homo erectus? And as I mentioned last week, of all the science faith organizations I know of, Reasons to Believe today stands alone in saying Neanderthals are not human, Denisovans are not human, Homo erectus is not human, Homo heidelbergensis is not human. And the reason why I think these other science faith organizations actually promote the idea that they're all human is that they feel compelled by the genetic evidence that we have to include all these others, which is why we did a little series on the genetic distinctiveness of modern humans with respect to Neanderthals, the Denisovans, Homo erectus, and the great apes that share the planet with us. But that's kind of the driving force for that. And by the way, these organizations that do believe that Neanderthals and Denisovans are fully human, they take different positions. Some will say, well, the story about Adam and Eve in the Bible is not historical. It's not scientific. It's a metaphor. It's a myth. And there's actually a theological message that's being communicated here, not a scientific or historical message. And they take the position that the ancestors of human beings is a population of at least 10,000 individuals. But then there's another segment of these organizations that say, no, we really do believe, along with Reasons to Believe, that all of humanity is descended from one man and one woman, a literal Adam and Eve, from whom we're all descended. But they date that Adam as being 750,000 to 1 million years ago, and that he, this Adam, would have given birth to all the Neanderthals, the Denisovans, Heidelbergenses, and perhaps even Homo erectus. And so we kind of stand alone in saying that humanity is relatively recent, that Adam and Eve, according to what we see in Genesis chapter 2, must have been created sometime during the last ice age. And if you're not aware of that argument, what you see in Genesis chapter 2, it tells us that Adam was created outside the Garden of Eden, then God put him inside the garden. So that's a key distinctive. Eve did not see the outside of the garden until after the fall. Adam did see the outside of the garden before the fall. So you got to see the difference between what life was like outside the garden and inside the garden. But as Genesis 2 describes the garden, it says it's in the location where four rivers come together: the Tigris, the Euphrates, the Gihon, and the Pishon. And what's interesting about the text, it tells us where these four rivers flow out of, where they flow from. It says the Tigris and Euphrates flow through the nation of Asher, which is basically the modern nation of Iraq. So, and we see those rivers today. They still have the name, the Tigris and Euphrates. And then it tells us the Pishon flows out of the mountains of Havilah, where there is gold. And these are the mountains in the central western part of Arabia. And that river today is not flowing. But during the last ice age, the mountains of Havilah were covered with ice and snow. And that melting ice and snow caused the Pishon to flow through the mountainous region of Havilah and into the Persian Gulf. Then it names a fourth river, the Gihon, and it says the Gihon flows out of the mountains of Cush. Now, today we recognize the region of Cush as being Ethiopia, which has mountains as high as 16,000 feet. But during the last ice age, the mountains of Ethiopia were connected with the mountains of southwestern Arabia. And at that time, the sea level was about 300 to 390 feet lower. And so there was a land bridge joining eastern Africa to Arabia. And it says the Gihon flows out of the mountains of Cush. And again, that river is not flowing today. It's a dry riverbed. But during the last ice age, there would have been snow and ice on the mountains of Cush. And therefore, at the time that God created Adam, all four rivers were flowing because of, you know, significant ice and snow. Now, by the way, the Tigris and Euphrates today would also be dry if they were not being fed by the melting snow on the mountains of Ararat. So there's still ice and snow because those mountains are farther north, and Ararat is 17,000 feet high. And so the Tigris and Euphrates are flowing today. The Gihon, the Pishon are dry riverbeds. But if you actually look at a satellite map, and you'll see that map I included in the book Navigating Genesis, it shows you the locations of the four rivers and where they come together. They come together in a region that's in the southeastern part of the Persian Gulf. That region today is 200 feet below sea level, but during the last ice age, it would have been above sea level. And so that's why we date God creating Adam and Eve as sometime during the last ice age. And what's interesting about that, that's actually a more accurate date than you get from the scientific record. Now, in terms of trying to date the first human through DNA evidence or through, the various dating tools like thermoluminescence, optical luminescence, once you get earlier than 40 to 45,000 years ago, carbon-14 dating ceases to be reliable. Like any radiometric tool, it's only reliable within a factor of 7 of the half-life. And with carbon-14, the half-life is 5,715 years. Multiply that by 7, anything earlier than that becomes not very reliable. And so we're able to show that the first humans definitely predate at that time. But as far as how farther back it goes, when you're looking at the DNA tools, the uranium precipitation method, the spin resonance method, these are all methods that have huge systematic errors. And so when you read in the scientific literature, we have a date that tells us that humans date back as far as 300,000 years. Well, if we actually read the fine print and look at not only the statistical errors, but the systematic errors. The date, scientifically, for the first human beings is 150,000 plus or minus 150,000 years. So it's not a very certain range. Somewhere between 40 and 300,000 years ago is a scientific date for the first humans. The Bible actually gives us a more accurate date, sometime during the last ice age, which would be like 15,000 to 130,000 years ago. But if you go online at reasons.org, I've written three articles saying, during the last ice age, there were three relatively brief episodes when there was an easy migration route between the Persian Gulf and Eastern Africa. This is important because the earliest relics that we can indisputably attach to human beings show up in both Eastern Africa and the Persian Gulf. And there are three episodes during the last ice age when there was a very easy migration route, which means people could have migrated quickly back and forth between Eastern Africa and the Persian Gulf. And incidentally, they weren't alone. One of the articles that I wrote that you'll see at reasons.org is where they document that there's a certain species of rats that we now can document were also rapidly migrating between Eastern Africa and the Persian Gulf. And so what are those three episodes? I should have looked it up. I'll try to give you the approximate dates. One is somewhere around 57,000 years ago, 76 to 77,000 years ago, and about 117,000 years ago. But don't quote me. Go to the online article. It'll give you the actual range of dates. And each range is a few thousand years wide. Okay. What I want to deal with today, predominantly, is this issue. What are the best arguments that are being put forward by people who disagree with our position at Reasons to Believe? People who claim that Neanderthals are just as advanced as we human beings and should be included as part of the human species. And these pieces of evidence, they're in the scientific literature, and you can go to PubMed and read all these articles for yourself. And a lot of these articles are free to the public in their entirety, so you can check that out. But they're predominantly articles where they're claiming that Neanderthals were just as technologically capable as the earliest modern humans. And these are the range of evidences they cite. I've been over this before with you. The fact that they appear to be burying their dead, that they had control over fire. Last week we talked about the Neanderthal flute and how it really wasn't a flute at all. And so people misidentified this one bone that's been attributed to Neanderthals as being a musical instrument when it really had nothing to do with Neanderthals at all. And how they were using these technologically advanced spears. As we looked at last week, the Shawangunk spears that has been cited by many well-known Christian research scientists as well as theologians. They're simply long pieces of wood. There are spears that are no more advanced than the wooden spears that are being used by chimpanzees. They're just longer and heavier. And how I mentioned last week, you got people like William Lane Craig and Peter N. saying, wow, look at these advanced Neanderthals. They were using spears that are identical to what we use in the Olympics, the Olympic javelins. Well, if you actually read the scientific paper, they don't make that claim. They simply say that they have found these wooden spears that date to the time of the Neanderthals that have the same approximate length and width or length and weight of Olympic javelins. They're not saying they're identical to Olympic javelins, as many Christian theologians cite. And I actually showed you pictures last week where these pieces of wood are not even straight. They've got bends in them. So they are kind of like what you see the chimpanzees doing. They literally break a branch off of a tree. They'll strip the small branches off. They sharpen the point, and they use it as a spear for hunting. And it's possible that the Neanderthals were also using it for self-defense. It's hard to tell. We also discussed another frequently cited claim, and that was Neanderthal twine. I think we did a whole class on the Neanderthal twine. You can look at the recording. It turns out it was three tiny threads that knotted together at the bottom, and the total length of the threads was only 6 millimeters, about that much, and the knot itself was only a millimeter. And they tried to claim, hey, Neanderthal made this knot, and being able to make that knot means they had to be incredibly sophisticated. But I shared with you how birds make knots of the equivalent sophistication we see here. And if we actually look at the anatomy of the Neanderthal, it's clear they did not have the eye, brain, and hand coordination to make knots that tiny. Humans do, birds do, but none of the great apes do. Well, I want to get into three other examples that have been cited as evidence that Neanderthals must be as advanced as we are. By the way, we did look briefly at the control of fire. All we have is evidence that Neanderthals opportunistically took advantage of fire in the same way that chimpanzees opportunistically take advantage of fire. We have no evidence that they had actual control over fire or could start a fire. They simply took advantage of wildfires that occurred. And some of the best evidence for that is where we do see an association between Neanderthals and fire, it's in the summertime, not the wintertime. And if they actually had control over fire, we would see that they'd be using it more in the wintertime than the summertime. We also have no evidence that they were cooking their food. And as far as burial goes, keep in mind many species bury their dead. Probably the best known example, non-human example, would be elephants. When the matriarch elephant dies, all the other elephants will gather around the dead matriarch and they'll bury the dead matriarch with vegetation until the dead matriarch is completely buried, and they're basically expressing their grief. You know, say, what's the evidence they have for Neanderthals burying their dead? Well, they'll find a Neanderthal bone that's been buried, one or two bones, and then about 20 or 30 feet away, they find pollen associated with flowers. And so people draw the conclusion, well, the Neanderthals were burying their dead and they were throwing flowers upon the grave. However, a number of researchers have said it's simply chance that the flower pollen happened to be found next to these Neanderthal bones. The flower pollen isn't even at the same level, and it's, you know, 20, 30 feet away, and there's lots of flower pollen. I mean, just look at our hills around here. No matter where you go, with all the rain we've been having, there's flower pollen everywhere. Well, let me jump into this, and let's look at the tools. In the literature, this is given as the best example of the most sophisticated tools. And this is what I would say, there's an important caveat. It's the best undisputed example of Neanderthal tool use. There is some disputed claims where people are claiming that Neanderthals were hafting these stone spear-like items to a piece of wood to make a spear. So they're actually claiming that Neanderthals were able to take, say, a Schwenningen spear, and they were able to use some kind of twine and glue and attach a sharpened stone point to the spear, just like humans were doing all the way back to the origin of humanity. Now, that's all based on the fact that they found one of these sharpened stone tips, and again, several feet away, they found evidence for tar. And so they said, well, the Neanderthals must have been using the tar to attach this to a spear. But my colleague Fazal Rana has written several articles at reasons.org saying there's no evidence they're actually using this tar, that the tar that they found was not manufactured. It's naturally occurring tar. And, you know, I grew up in coastal British Columbia. If you ever walk any of the forest trails, you see droppings of pine tar everywhere. And so tar does show up without any human need at all. But this is the earliest undisputed evidence. And these indeed are the most sophisticated stone tools that we've seen before the human era. And you can tell that they've been shaped. In other words, what these Neanderthals were doing was taking a small piece of rock and they were hammering it with another piece of rock and basically shaping it into a sharpened point. But the thing that we notice here is that the shaping occurs in only one side of the stone. It's what we call single facial shaping, whereas what humans were doing was multifacial shaping, where they would basically use stone tools and basically they were chipping off pieces all around this to make a very sophisticated tool. But these are the best undisputed examples and way more advanced than we see with, say, Homo erectus. And here's a close-up of what they're doing here. But this is not a bow and arrow. It's not a hafted spear. It's not a shovel. It's not an axe. It's nothing like the sophistication that we see with the earliest humans. In every case, we're looking at a tool that's a single piece of rock. And you know, that could have been used to scrape flesh off of a bone. That bottom one, for example, is considered to be a scraping tool. And Neanderthals were using obsidian. There's several marvelous obsidian deposits here in California. One up in the Sierras is probably the best known. And you can just walk around there, and the obsidian is like solid pieces of glass. And so even without any shaping at all, you can find pieces that would make very effective as single stone tools. Well, one debate I had with a scientist who was trying to claim that Neanderthals were just as fully human as we are, cited this cave. And this is a cave that was occupied by bears, by humans, and by Neanderthals. But yeah, there's a lot of Neanderthal relics that they've been able to find here. But this particular image has been cited as evidence that Neanderthals were not only living in caves, they were building structures, homes inside the cave. You say, well, how did they figure that out? Well, what they did is they went around the cave, and what you notice is there's a lot of broken stalactites. I mean, if you're in a limestone cave, you get these, you know, carbonate structures that come down from the ceiling and they drip, and so you get structures that come up. And so what they're claiming is that Neanderthals were breaking these off the ceiling, breaking these off the floor, and assembling them to make a home or a structure in which they live. But this is the extent of the evidence. What they find here littered on the floor are broken pieces of this carbonate that was once attached to the ceiling or to the floor. Now, how many have ever been in any of these limestone caves? I've been in several of them. Every one I've been in, I see broken pieces at the bottom, because this stuff just breaks off naturally. Now, what's unusual about this cave is just how many broken pieces there are. And so people have been saying, this is not just like a cave where you get these pieces breaking off just because of gravitational stress. Somebody was actually breaking the pieces off. But given that this cave was occupied by bears and Neanderthals and humans, I mean, you can imagine a bear walking through this cave as it bumps into these things. Bears are powerful animals. They're going to break pieces off. So it is true that this cave has an unusual number of broken pieces, but they're randomly distributed. There's no evidence that, you know, that they were being stacked up to make a habitat, you know, with walls and a roof and windows and doors. It's just simply loose pieces of broken things that were put there. Okay. Now, a couple of weeks ago, one of you was asking me, well, what about these papers that claim that Neanderthals were just as symbolically advanced as we human beings? I mean, one of the features of human beings is we invent and use symbols. You know, you got the alphabet, you got the number system. In mathematics, we got all these fancy symbols that we use to be able to do mathematical calculations. And yes, a number of papers have been published where they're claiming that Neanderthals are just as symbolically advanced as we human beings. And what I want to show you in the next slide is the best cited example of symbolic use by Neanderthals. This is it. Okay, a couple of scratches on a wall. And they're claiming, well, you know, this is probably the alphabet system that was used by Neanderthals. But I think that's a bit of a stretch. I mean, you might imagine, and they make the point, hey, some of the letters in the Cyrillic alphabet kind of look like this. And, you know, even in our Roman alphabet, you got the letter T, which looks like a scratch like this with a scratch across. And, you know, if you look at my handwriting, it might kind of look like that, okay? But a number of papers have been published saying, no, this is not evidence that Neanderthals were inventing and using complex symbols. It's simply evidence that they were making scratches on a wall. And actually, you do see scratch structures like this from bears. And so I've seen bears do this on trees. And you know, some bears, like the grizzlies, are capable of doing that on cave walls. So, but the fact that this is the best evidence that they've been able to support, I think is sufficient to tell us they were not using an alphabet or a number system. They were not using symbols like we humans use symbols. Okay, I want to finish this before we get into our Q&A time. By wrapping up some of the discussion I got started a few weeks ago on the differences between the Neanderthal brain and the human brain. And again, as I shared last week, 50 years ago, when I did my first debate on this subject, an anthropologist was insisting that Neanderthals were anatomically identical to humans and their brains were anatomically identical to our brains. Well, this is what the human brain looks like without the skull. So you got two well-defined hemispheres, and what you see is that human brain is almost as high as it is long. And as I think I showed you this a couple of weeks ago, it's a comparison of the human skull and the Neanderthal skull. And you can see just in this thing that they're not anatomically identical. The human skull is very different from the Neanderthal skull. In fact, in the scientific literature, they're citing this as the best example that humans are anatomically distinct from Neanderthals, from the Denisovans, and Homo erectus. And here are two actual skulls. These are real skulls that you see in the museum. And you can see it, that the shape of the skull is different. I mean, the face is different and the skull is different. And so with the Neanderthal, you have an elongated skull, kind of like a football shape. With the human, you've got a globular skull, kind of like a basketball shape. And you also notice that the face structure is radically different. With the Neanderthal, you've got a jaw large enough and protruding outward enough that it can have very powerful jaw muscles. Again, this is evidence that the Neanderthals were chewing raw meat rather than cooking their food. The human anatomy is not designed for chewing rough meat. And I think it was several weeks ago I mentioned a little bit too how when you look at human beings, we spend 7 to 69 minutes a day chewing our food. When you look at the great apes, they spend 4 to 7 hours a day chewing their food. And if you look at the amount of energy that humans put into chewing their food, it's just a tiny percentage of their daily energy needs. We're talking 1 or 2%. With the great apes, we're looking at something like 25 to 30% of their total energy expenditure is devoted to chewing their food. Because they're chewing raw vegetable material, they're chewing raw animal material, and it takes a lot of energy to process that. And also, field studies have been done. When you look at the great apes and they're eating their food, they do it in isolation. When you look at humans, when they're chewing their food, they're socializing. I mean, some of you will go to lunch afterwards, and you know, we love to get together with our friends and eat and talk, and we're the only species that's really capable of doing that. And our jaw structure simply doesn't permit us to be able to eat coarse food. And so humans immediately were cooking their food and processing their food. And there's actually scientific research showing that as far back as you can go into early humanity, as far back as 36,000 years, we have clear, undisputed evidence that humans were processing and cooking their food. Actually collecting grains, roasting the grains, grinding the grains, and cooking the grains, and baking them to make a variety of bakery products. And we had to do that because we didn't have the anatomy to be able to process coarse food. We have an amazing anatomy to process soft food. And the way the human facial structure and jaw structure is designed, it's designed to optimally process soft food with very high efficiency and very little energy requirement, which enables us to eat and talk at the same time, and even to eat and think at the same time. In fact, I can recall when I first did my research at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, I went into the lunchroom there, and there was places on the table, and they had plates and napkins beside all the places where the astronomers would sit and eat their lunch and their dinner. But beside each plate was a pencil and a calculator and a notepad, because they knew that when the astronomers would sit down and have their meals, this would be the time that they would do their most complex research, because they could kind of talk to one another and work on problems. And I said, well, how did you come up with this? I said, you have no idea how many tablecloths these astronomers ruined. Because before we put calculators and notebooks and pens and pencils on the table, they would draw out their own pens, usually a felt-tip pen, and they'd be scribbling on the tablecloth. And it just cost us too much money. It was cheaper to put a calculator and a notepad and a pencil beside every place. But that just kind of shows you, we're designed to be able to think all the time. The other thing you'll notice with the Neanderthal is that they have these huge eye sockets. Their eyes are probably bigger than our eyes, but we also know that they didn't have the brain structure that enabled what their eyes were processing to the degree that we humans do. We humans stand alone in our amazing eye-hand coordination. And it's not because we got such amazingly designed eyes, it's because we got the frontal cranial brain lobes that are able to process that information. And as you look at the Neanderthal, you can tell by the skull shape that they're lacking large frontal lobes, whereas a human has that. And also notice that the human brain extends a lot farther down into the skull than it does with the Neanderthal. This probably shows up well in this image, where you see that the brain is kind of elongated like this. It's not very thick, whereas the human brain has a lot of thickness. And this also shows you just how elongated the Neanderthal brain was relative to the human brain. So a narrower skull structure. Here you can see the huge eye sockets, the heavy brow above the forehead, basically designed to protect the eyes. Humans being more technologically advanced didn't need that protection. The other thing you notice here is look how big that nose structure is. Neanderthals had big noses and had this very large nasal capacity. And relative to the size of the skull is now recognized, Neanderthals amongst all mammals have the largest nasal capacity, which would be useful when you live in a cold climate that allows you time to warm up the air. And then we have this image here, which basically again shows you the distinctiveness of the human brain relative to Neanderthals. This is Neanderthals on both sides. Basically shows you how compressed or shallow the skull is, particularly the image on the right. It's not like a human where you got a high forehead. The forehead is quite shallow. You got these enormous eye sockets. Notice the chin structure. And so the chin is a very heavy bone. It's wide, unlike the triangular one that we humans have. Again, it's designed to support very large jaw muscles that were needed to be able to process the food that they were eating, but also implied that they had to spend, like the great apes, hours a day processing their food. And here again is a detailed reconstruction of the Neanderthal skull, again showing the small forehead, the huge jaw structure, and the bones there to support these big muscles. So again, you can check this out online. And I think previous, I'm not going to go over this because we covered this before in a previous episode of Paradoxes, just the differences between the internal structure. So today what I kind of did is showed you the external structure of the Neanderthal skull compared to the human skull. But as you look at the interior brain structure, we can see dramatic differences between the human brain and the Neanderthal brain, basically making the point they couldn't have been as technologically advanced as we are or as symbolically capable. They simply lacked the brain structure to do that. In fact, the closest we come to the human brain structure that matches ours is not in the great apes, it's not in Neanderthal or the Denisovans, it's in ravens and Caledonian crows. They come the closest to matching our brain structure. And one thing I didn't cover last time is that, oh, maybe I did, is when you look at ravens and the Caledonian crows, they have a brain structure, a skull structure, that emulates the human brain structure. And one reason why these birds are so smart is they have an extremely high density of neurons, way denser than what we humans have in our brain. But because the brain is relatively small, they can keep the brain cool. And these are birds that are flying around all the time. As they fly around, it keeps their brain cool. And you know, if we humans had that kind of neuron density, then we'd be cooking our brains, and literally cooking our brains to death. Nevertheless, it is now known that the neuron density in the human brain is at least double that in the Neanderthal brain. So yes, it is true that Neanderthals had a brain just as heavy as the human brain, but we have twice as many minimum neurons in that brain that the Neanderthal brain has. And so, and the neuron density is at the maximum. The human brain has the greatest number of neurons possible to avoid the brain cooking itself to death. And that's one reason why we've noticed this with our children when they get a fever. You take the temperature, because the temperature gets too high, those neurons begin to die. And so, like if the temperature gets up to 104, 105, you as a parent know, the hospital doctors know, we have to bring that temperature down. A few hours is okay, but to tolerate a temperature of 105 for several days means you are gonna have brain damage. And that's because the human brain is designed to have the maximum number of neurons. So we got a big brain, it's densely packed with neurons. That explains why our brains are able to think at the level that they do. Okay, let's take questions. And as usual, alternate between people that are here present and people who are participating with us online. And hey, there are great treats over there at the table. It will not offend me at all if you get up from your table, walk over and bring them back and share them with everybody else around you. Okay, Ross, what do we got?
Thank you, Dr. Ross. I want to invite anybody in the live audience or the internet audience to ask a question. And like you say, we'll take turns. The first question comes from Keith Wilson. He asks, is the elliptical orbit of our moon necessary for life on Earth?
Well, the elliptical orbit of the moon is necessary because it's governed by Newtonian mechanics. It was Isaac Newton and you know, Kepler that figured out that if bodies are subject to the law of gravity, their orbits must be elliptical. And so all celestial bodies orbit one another with elliptical orbits. It's simply an outcome of the law of gravity. Now, our planet Earth has a distinction of having an orbit that's very close to circular. Right now, it's close to circular. In the past, it was more elliptical. That's the other thing we notice, is that if you got more than two bodies involved, not just a star and a planet, but say a star, a planet, a moon, or other planets in the same system, the shape of the orbit will vary over time. And so Earth's orbit becomes more elliptical and less elliptical. But its departure from a perfect circle is never more than 5%. And usually right now it's actually significantly less than 1%. And so having a nearly circular orbit right now is good for advanced life. And so yes, to answer Keith's question, the moon has an elliptical orbit. Is it fine-tuned? Well, it's fine-tuned in that the orbit is not exceptionally elliptical. It is more elliptical than Earth's orbit. But as we look at other bodies, other planets orbiting other stars, many of them have a very high eccentricity, which means the departure from a circle, so the ellipse becomes long instead of short. And if you have a high eccentricity, that would be a problem, because that would mean that as the moon orbits around the Earth, there'll be times when the tidal forces exerted in the Earth are weak, and other times where they're strong, and the tidal forces exerted by the moon and the sun, because the sun also exerts tidal forces on the Earth. The tidal forces we get from the moon and the sun are indeed optimized for an abundance and diversity of life on planet Earth.
Hi there. My question is about a passage in Genesis 6 about the Nephilim, where it says the Nephilim were not on Earth in those days and also afterward, when the sons of God went to the daughters of human and had children by them. If I'm to believe, the sons of God are not humans from that passage, and probably the only likely explanation is that they're angels of some sort, or fallen angels. Does this imply that angels have a knowledge of genetics? They would have had to create their own bodies, their own genes, to give these daughters sons. And I would love your answer.
Okay, what a question. Highly controversial amongst Christian theologians. I do address it in depth in Navigating Genesis. I think it's chapter 16 and appendix C where I go into this in depth. And what I review for you are the three theories that are debated amongst Christian theologians. One theory is that God forbade the sons of Seth from marrying the daughters of Cain. And so, so the sons of Seth that violated that command are the sons of God. Another theory is like the one you suggest. These are angels, fallen angels, that came down and had children by the daughters of men. A third theory is that they're demon-possessed men that had these children by the women. Now, what the text is saying is that these sons of God did this before the flood, and they did it after the flood. Different set, because I think one of the purposes of the flood was to rid the earth of these sons of God. So they got wiped out, but evidently other sons of God replaced them after the flood. And you say, what happened to those sons of God? Well, that's kind of what I try to talk about in Navigating Genesis. And, evidence that they had to be angelic beings, or angelic beings that were possessing humans, demon-possessed humans, is the fact that this term, sons of God, is only indisputably used for humans after the day of Pentecost. I mean, you'll see this in the gospel accounts. Jesus referred to his followers before he rose bodily from the dead as children of men and sons of men. He also referred to himself as a son of man. But once you get past the day of Pentecost, he only refers to his disciples as sons of God and children of God. And Jesus is exclusively referred to as a son of God. He's never called the son of man in the epistles. So there's something about, and it was Jesus who said to his disciples in the gospels, when I rise bodily from the dead and the Holy Spirit comes upon you and permanently indwells you, referring to the day of Pentecost, you'll become the salt of the earth. Basically saying there's something that's going to be different that's going to happen when the Holy Spirit comes upon you. And evidently, this is when the followers of God no longer are called sons of men, they're called sons of God. Now, We do see in the Old Testament references to sons of God in the book of Job. It's in the first chapter of Job. It's also in Job 7, where it says the sons of God were witnesses to God laying down the foundations of the earth. That seems to be a reference to angelic beings, because we weren't around then. And we were created last of all, but you know, the angels may have been created very early in the God system. And so sons of God can refer to angels, they can refer to humans, but it seems like they can only refer to humans that have been baptized in the Holy Spirit, post-day of Pentecost, which would be strong evidence that these sons of God have to be angelic beings, or some theologians have argued, demon-possessed human beings, endowing these humans with supernatural power. Now, theologians who argue that it's not angels, they basically make the argument, it says explicitly in Scripture, the angels do not marry. And therefore, they said that eliminates the possibility that in Genesis 6, it's referring to that. Now, there's a comeback on that. It says, yes, the text says they do not marry. It does not say they cannot marry. And then you got an interesting reference in the sixth verse of Jude, where it refers to fallen angels that have left their estate, referring to the fallen angels that God sent to the abyss. Basically making, and then when it uses that Greek phrase, left their estate, it's a similar phrase in the Greek that would refer to someone who has committed bestiality. So it's implying that the abyss is for the angels that violated God's command, which says, don't mess with these human beings. The fact that they did, they got sent to the abyss. And what you see in the gospel accounts is Jesus would cast out demons, and the demons would say to Jesus, do not send us to the abyss. What you notice is he never did. Basically acknowledging you haven't done sin to a sufficient degree that you deserve going to the abyss. The abyss apparently is exclusively reserved for angels that left their estate, which is evidence that it's actual angels, not just demon-possessed humans, that are the ones that we see in Genesis 6:2 and 6:4, where they came, and you know, given the evil of these fallen angels, we can see why God was so intent on making sure that the earth was rid of these people. So that's one purpose of the flood, was to eliminate the sons of God. But the text says in verse 4, they came after the flood. They came back and say, well, what did God deal with them? Well, you see these Nephilim. They're the offspring of the intercourse between the sons of God and the daughters of men. And it tells us that these are the heroes of old, the giants. Goliath was part of the Nephilim. The king of Bashan was part of the Nephilim. And we don't know a lot about these creatures, but we do know that they often had birth defects. The text says that some of them had six toes and six fingers, and so they had birth defects. We don't see any evidence of female Nephilim. All we see are masculine Nephilim, which again would be evidence of some kind of bestiality was going on. They're all very wicked, but they're also had supernatural capacities, because the shortest of the Nephilim that we see mentioned in the Bible was Goliath, and he was a minimum of 9 feet 9 inches tall. And any human of that height quickly dies from physical exertion. I mean, the tallest human that ever lived was 8'11" and didn't make it to age 40, and never could play basketball, because he just couldn't move his body around. And it's simple physics. If you're bipedal, the taller the body, the heavier the bone structure to support that body, and the weight of the bone structure goes up with the square of the height of the body, which explains why the tallest basketball players in the NBA are not very mobile, not as mobile. So there's a big difference between the mobility of a 7-foot-tall basketball player and a 5-foot-tall basketball player. The 5-footer can run circles around the 7-footer, but of course the 7-footer can make baskets a lot easier because of their great height. And so this is why you want a combination. There's a reason why the point guards are not so tall. You want them to be able to run fast and quick and be mobile, and you'll want the centers to be tall because they can center the basket, take a pass from the short ones, and drop it in the basket. But given that Og had a bed 13 feet long minimum and 6 feet wide made out of iron, he must have been a big dude and way bigger. It also explains why when Moses sent out the spies, he said, we look like grasshoppers in front of him. Well, you can imagine, someone is, say, 12 feet tall, you would look kind of tiny next to someone who's 12 feet tall. Matter of fact, you know, I'm just under 6 feet. I remember having my photograph taken with a basketball player that was 7'2½". And, you know, a lot of his height was in his legs. I was kind of looking at his belt buckle. So it really is intimidating to be next to someone of that height. By the way, he was a marvelous Christian. It was part of our Bible study there. This is why I tend to favor the interpretation, it really is, of fallen angels. But I can see arguments for all three interpretations. Sorry to be so long, but every time I give a short answer to that question, I get myself into big trouble.
Hugh, I want to follow up on Tim's question, because part of his question had to do with if immaterial angels can come down and have children with material women, doesn't that mean that they somehow had to kludge together some genetic material and write the DNA code to be able to get a sperm to have a child? How would that work?
Again, you know, it says that they do not marry, but it doesn't say they cannot marry. And angels have the capacity to enter into our realm and leave our realm. They can appear in non-material form in our realm. God has given them the power to appear in material form. And we see examples in the Old Testament where, for example, you got Abraham feeding dinner to angels. Lot entertained angels. And so evidently, angels can take on sufficient physical to us that they can, you know, sleep, they can eat, they can do all the physical things we do. And it says in Hebrews 13:2, many of us have entertained angels unawares. In other words, they can appear in a form that is so physical and so human-like, we mistake them for a human being, which may explain why these fallen angels were able to woo the daughters of humans and marry them and have children by them, because for all intents and purposes, they looked and behaved just like human beings do, which would imply that they had the capacity for injecting sperm into the women. Again, a lot of this is speculative. Yeah. The Bible doesn't give specifics, but it does tell us the sons of God did have intercourse with the daughters of men and produced children by them. And the children had features that seemed to defy the limitations of the physics that we humans are subject to, which means there was something supernatural, not only about the sons of God, but something supernatural about the children that they gave birth to. It also explains why God was so intent on ridding the earth of all the Nephilim. So the flood took care of the ones before that. What we see afterwards is one reason why God raised up the children of Israel was to wipe out the remaining Nephilim on the face of the earth. Evidently, the Nephilim were not as prevalent after the flood as they were before the flood. In fact, the only historical evidence we have for people of a super human height would be in the land of Canaan and in Crete. So you do see in Crete a lot of historical evidence that there were individuals living there that were of great height. And where did the Philistines come from, by the way? They came from the island of Crete. They migrated from Crete into Palestine. And when the Israelites entered into the land of Canaan, guess where the Nephilim lived? They lived amongst the Philistines. And what got rid of them? David's mighty men. David's mighty men wiped out the last of the Nephilim. I say that because there are actual preachers today who are claiming the Nephilim are still running around. And yeah, when you look at some of these NBA games, you might think that they're still running around. But no, we're talking 9 feet plus. So I see no evidence that they are around and no evidence that they're manifesting the tremendous degree of evil that we see recorded and attributed to the Nephilim in the text.
Hugh, we have another question from Val Durham. She says, the Göbekli Tepe site in southern Turkey consists of highly advanced stone monument tooling and possible religious petroglyph reliefs, but it dates to 12,000 years ago. This doesn't agree with the historic paradigm. What do you think is going on at Göbekli Tepe?
Well, that site in Turkey has been cited as evidence that humans were actually fairly advanced even before the Neolithic Revolution. Neolithic Revolution was about 11 to 12,000 years ago. This is when the last ice from the last ice age had melted away. It's when the climate stabilized, and with the stabilization of the climate, we see a rapid advance in technology and civilization. But that particular site in Turkey, and it's not the only one, there's several sites in Turkey, also in the Levant area, where we see evidence for significant technological advance, but it's at a very small scale level. Not until the Neolithic Revolution does it become ubiquitous. Not until the Neolithic Revolution do we see the human population rising dramatically. That's when humans, thanks to climate stability, are able to actually set free a significant percentage of their population from simply having to get enough food to stay alive. So that's when you actually see people dedicating their whole time to philosophy, to writing, to storytelling, to art, because now they could produce a sufficient surplus of food that a significant percentage of the human population could be set free to do other things besides just coming up with the food that they needed for survival. So now if you go back earlier, I mean, there you're talking about 12 to 20,000 years ago are the artifacts in that site, but there's other places, particularly caves, where you got evidence of human technological advance that dates back 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 years ago. And the challenge there is that in those caves, you got evidence that they were inhabited by humans, by Neanderthals or Denisovans, by bears, and by other animals. And if you go into those caves, you actually see that they had been used by a lot of different species of life. So it makes it difficult because people say, well, look, we found this artifact in this layer. But if the layer got moved, it may have nothing to do with the bones you see in the same area.
Thank you, Hugh. Thomas Uy says, good Palm Sunday, Dr. Ross. Do you consider the S. School Kafsa cave hominids in Israel from 100,000 years ago as Neanderthals or modern humans? Does your view differ from Fuzz Rana? And Thomas is in Wake Forest, North Carolina.
Right. Well, around Mount Carmel, there's a number of caves where they found a lot of artifacts. And some of these artifacts have been attributed to modern humans. Others have been attributed to Neanderthals. And the problem with the dates is it's in that range where you got huge systematic errors. An article that you can find at reasons.org, just look under human origins dating. It's a long article I wrote where I analyze the different dating methods that are used for dating artifacts that date earlier than 40,000 years ago. Basically making the point that there's a window between about 40,000 years ago and about 280,000 years ago where we do not have any reliable radiometric tools. And so we're forced to use tools that have significant systematic errors, where you have to make assumptions. Well, was that artifact buried the whole time, or was it exposed to light, or was it disturbed by a bear? Because the dates that are usually given in the scientific literature assume no disturbance, or they assume no exposure to light over the entire time, which means that most of these dates that you see need to be interpreted as upper limits. And so, for example, there are dates of artifacts in those caves in Mount Carmel where they say This is evidence that this was occupied by modern humans dating back 78,000 years ago. But it's 78,000 maximum. It could be more recent. So somewhere between 78,000. You see, how big are these error bars? Well, sometimes the error bars are as large as plus or minus 2,000%, which means it could be anywhere from 78,000 years ago to, say, 15,000 years ago. So the range is broad. And part of the problem is when you read the scientific papers, because there's such a difficulty trying to establish what the systematic error is or how big the systematic error is, the scientists publishing these articles typically only give you the statistical errors. And so they'll say, well, we got a date here by electron spin resonance. That's 48,000 years ago, plus or minus 3,000 years. That plus or minus 3,000 years is only looking at the measuring errors. It's not looking at the systematic errors, which could shift all the measuring errors either up or down, and they can shift them up and down by tens of thousands of years. So hopefully that helps. Again, go to the article, Human Origins Dating. I get into the details of what the systematic errors are and how big they are. Which basically means it's going to be really hard to pin anything down that's in that range between 40 and, say, 270,000 years ago.
Hi, Hugh. What would be ratio, I'll try to leave it generic, let you tune it in, of neuronal populations of the human neocortex versus non-human?
Okay, say that again, human cortex?
Yeah, the neuronal population of the human cortex, neocortex, versus non-human, or Neanderthal, or whatever you care to answer.
What is clear is that the cortex for the human brain is radically different from the cortex of any other primate that we know of. Exactly how many neurons are packed into there, I don't know the answer to that. It's something we could look up, but certainly the shape and the size of the cortex and where it is in the brain, that's where we see significant differences. And I think we talked about the cortex in a previous paradoxes class, so that should be recorded a few weeks ago. But yeah, I don't know the number.
That's only like the third time in 25 years I've ever heard you say I don't know.
Well, if you talk to my wife, I think you'd be able to get a much longer list.
James Vierdig says, Dr. Ross, what is the best argument against other intelligent life forms elsewhere in the universe?
Okay, one argument would be we can't even find a star that's sufficiently like the sun that it could be a candidate to have life orbiting around it. You'll see a whole chapter on the sun and other stars in Design to the Core. And I actually have a diagram in there, an image, a photograph, which shows you the luminosity stability of the sun compared to the star that we found that places second to the sun in luminosity stability. The sun is 5 times more stable. Now, that star that is 5 times more unstable, that luminosity instability wouldn't be a problem for plants or trees or microbes, but it would be a problem for advanced life capable of developing advanced technology. We need a very stable sun in order to be able to develop the technology that we've developed. Just like we were mentioning about the Neolithic Revolution, it took the stabilization of our climate to an extraordinary degree for us to be able to develop the advanced technology. If it wasn't for that stable climate, we'd still be struggling like humans were before the Neolithic Revolution. So, and I have a lot of friends in the astronomical community that are spending their time searching for extraterrestrial intelligence signals. But what I find amazing is none of them have yet to find a star that's a worthy candidate. They're saying, well, this planet is kind of like Earth. Let's see if we see some signals from there. And what I've been sharing with, look, we already know it's orbiting the wrong kind of star. Let's not waste the telescope time. I can think of much better uses for telescope time than looking for intelligent signals on a star or a planet that we already know is not a candidate. I started off the book Design to the Core with a quote from Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's an atheist astrophysicist, at least here in America, probably the best known astrophysicist because he's such a well-known public figure. But I quoted him early in the book saying, and this was kind of an offhanded comment he made, where he said, the universe is out to kill us. And his comment is, once you get past planet Earth, conditions are incredibly hostile for advanced life. And so his point is, we better take good care of planet Earth because there's nowhere else to go. Everywhere else we look, we see conditions that are extremely hostile for advanced life. I've written a number of articles on this. Matter of fact, I just submitted an article for a peer-reviewed journal, and good news, it got accepted, so I know it's going to get published. Last week, I couldn't tell you whether it got accepted or not. It did get accepted. However, they asked me to add about 2,000 words of additional endnotes in the scientific literature. So the article is now 14,000 words long instead of 11,000 words long. I'll give you a link once it gets published. But basically what I do in that book is address the issue. Is there life elsewhere in the universe? And I'm not saying that there couldn't be. It's just that everywhere we've looked, we see conditions that are hostile for advanced life. And we actually do find some place, it's because God created it. It's not because it happened naturalistically.
Thank you, Hugh. Jama Slama wants to know regarding the giants. Why don't we find 12-foot-plus humanoid skeletons? And also, were not humans smaller back during the flood and the measurements in cubits? Wouldn't that explain why we don't find extremely large skeletons?
Okay, good question. And what you'll see in the Bible is they have this unit called a cubit. So it says of Goliath, he was 6 cubits high plus a hand width. And, using a short cubit, because in the Hebrew literature, they have this unit of length called a cubit, and they've got 2 short units and 1 long unit. And the units are 18 inches, 22 inches, and it's half a yard, which would be, it's 18, 22, and 36 inches. And so I'm using the short cubit. Even with a short cubit, you got Goliath at least 9 feet, 9 inches tall, and you got Og, the king of Bashan, about 12 feet tall. So now if you use the long cubit, they're even bigger. Now as to why we don't find the skeletons, well, I think the flood was catastrophic enough that it actually resulted in all the humans living before the flood that were killed being completely decayed away. In terms of the dates of the earliest indisputably human skeletons, the earliest we find is about 35,000 years old, which would be post-flood, so we don't have any evidence of skeletons that predate the flood. And say, as far as what happened after the flood, after all, the Bible tells us that Nephilim were around even 3,000 years ago. That's when David's mighty men killed off the last of the Nephilim. Why don't we find their skeletal remains? Well, if you look at the historical books in the Old Testament, there were these tall Nephilim running around, but there weren't very many of them. They were few in number. And given how few they were, we shouldn't expect to find skeletal remains of them. Now, it doesn't mean we might not be lucky and one day find them, but after all, we don't have the bones of Solomon. We don't have the bones of King David. When you die, typically what happens to your skeleton, it decays. It takes highly unusual circumstances for the bones to be preserved for several hundred years. So I'm not at all surprised we don't have skeletal remains of the Nephilim. And I don't expect we're going to find any either. But hey, if it gets published one day, I'll be excited.
This is probably our last question. Jay Grauman says, If we are related to Neanderthals, wouldn't all humanity have some Neanderthal DNA?
Yeah, this is a major debate going on among scientists and Christian theologians. Was there ever any sexual contact between humans and Neanderthals? And this goes back to a paper published about 15 years ago where they pointed out that Europeans have a higher DNA similarity with Neanderthals than we get with sub-Saharan Africans. And actually you see a higher DNA similarity with the Oceanic peoples, the Asians, and the native peoples living in North and South America. So it's not just Europeans, but you see the greatest similarity with the Europeans. But with the Asians, it comes up almost as high. And so they're saying, well, we know the sub-Saharan Africans couldn't have had contact with the Neanderthals. Europeans were living in the same region they were. The reason why we see this greater DNA similarity is that there was some limited amount of intercourse between humans and Neanderthals. Now, the paper that got this all started basically concluded that we only see a small amount of evidence that would indicate that there was sexual contact. In fact, they concluded their paper saying, if indeed there was sexual contact, it's at a level that's significantly lower than the level of sexual contact between humans and the great apes that happens today. In other words, they concluded their paper, there must have been a strong taboo against humans, even at that time, having any sexual contact with a non-human animal. And so it's still being disputed today whether or not this actually happened or didn't happen. What we do see agreed upon, however, is that the DNA similarity, that we, the extra DNA similarity we see with Europeans compared to the sub-Saharan Africans, none of that extra DNA similarity with Neanderthals has any impact on the anatomy of or the behavior of Europeans relative to sub-Saharan Africans. In other words, we can't detect any difference in terms of anatomy or behavior between sub-Saharan Africans and Northern Europeans, basically making the point, if indeed there was sexual contact, it didn't have any measurable impact on the difference, and therefore this could never be used as an argument for racial preference. And so, and that's agreed upon by all the people in the scientific literature, that this is not an excuse for racist expressions, because we can't see any measurable impact in terms of the anatomy or the behavior. And incidentally, in terms of genetic differences, we see greater genetic difference between two African tribes in South Africa than we see between sub-Saharan Africans and Europeans. The Bantu blacks and the Zulu blacks have the greatest genetic distinctiveness amongst all the ethnic groups on planet Earth, basically making the point there really is no genetic basis for racism whatsoever. The genetic differences between the different races and the ethnic groups of the human population are really trivial. So, but the debate is still ongoing. But the bottom line is, no matter how you interpret it, it couldn't have had any impact. I will tell you that the latest research is saying that the earliest Europeans, in other words, people who have been dead in Europe for 25,000 years compared to modern Europeans, they, ones that have been dead for 25,000 years, do show a slightly greater similarity with Neanderthal DNA than Europeans today. And that has been cited as the strongest evidence that indeed there was sexual contact. Now, the skeptics have been pointing out this is not at all surprising. European humans 25,000 years ago were not moving around, and they were not, you know, marrying and having children with people of different human ethnic backgrounds. It's not like today where you can get on an airplane, take a vacation in another part of the world, meet somebody, wind up getting married and having children. And therefore, we shouldn't be surprised that the earliest Europeans have a little more, and by the way, it's just a slight measure, have a greater similarity than we see with Europeans today. But the thing about Europeans today, they're intermarrying with people of all different backgrounds, especially given the migrations of people into Europe from different parts of the world. So that's where the debate stands right now. I've listened to scholars on both sides of the debate, and I don't think any one of them has overwhelming evidence against the other position. And by the way, I don't think it matters because it has no impact on anatomy or behavior. And by the way, I wouldn't put it past Satan. I mean, after all, we just talked about Genesis chapter 6, how we have these sons of God coming and have intercourse with the daughters of men. And the bestiality has been going on throughout all of human history. And from my theological perspective, it would make rational sense that Satan and the demons would do everything they could to damage the image of God. And what better way to do it than by motivating people to engage in bestial sexual behavior. It also explains why in the book of Leviticus, we see the strongest prohibition of any text in the entire Bible against bestiality. I mean, the language that's used there in Leviticus, basically forbidding that kind of behavior, is not used anywhere else in the Bible. So again, I think that's making the point. There's a battle going on between God and Satan trying to protect or destroy the image of God amongst us humans.
Hugh, we're always grateful for you being here. Thank you. Would you please close us in prayer?
Be happy to do that and remind all of you we are going to meet on Easter next week. Father in heaven, we do thank you for the privilege of being alive today, being created by you. Lord, we thank you that you chose to create us human beings and to use us to fulfill the purposes for which you created the universe and the rest of your creation. Help us to be worthy of that special privilege that you've granted to us. And particularly in these days, as we approach the culmination of this age and of the next age. And Father, I pray that you would give those of us who are followers of Jesus Christ opportunities to share the truth we learn from you. And Lord, to be ones that encourages people we meet to receive more of your love, life, and truth, and come into an eternal relationship with you. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.